Your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN. Here's Steve Bertrand.
And here we are live in the Showcase Studio, the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue on this beautiful Tuesday afternoon. Summer has arrived, the shorts are out, and everything looks fine up and down Michigan Avenue. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch on this Tuesday. We'll talk to Suzanne Muchen coming up a few minutes from now. You know, Suzanne has the podcast, The Big Payoff, and looks at women's issues in the workplace, so we will talk to Suzanne about what's going on. I would imagine with Michelle Wolf a little bit, it's sort of inescapable, but I'm also interested in what's going on at the White House and some of the stories there with John Kelly and all. So we'll kick that around with Suzanne in a few minutes. John Najarian joins us at the top on Tuesdays when we can find him. You know, he's a co-host on the Halftime Report on CNBC, and sometimes they take the fight to the locker room, and it takes a minute or two to get him on the phone. I don't know, Steve Alexander, if you're up following Wall Street in the business office this afternoon.
They take the fight to the locker room,
do they? Exactly. You know, sometimes he joins us on the phone, and you could hear the swelling.
So he and his brother, the one with the ponytail?
We're looking at Wall Street today, so I'm reading that the Dow is in line for maybe its lowest close in a month. What's going on there?
Well, down 1.4% right now, 343 points. And a couple of things going on. One is Apple is going to announce its earnings report after the closing bell today. That will help push the market one way or the other, I presume. And also the Fed is meeting again. And at 1 o'clock Chicago time tomorrow, we'll come out with its announcement of whether it's going to increase interest rates or not. Expectation widely is that it will not at this time.
Right. So almost everyone expects that they know what's going to happen. So why would that be holding up the market? Just they've got better things to do? They'll just wait it out?
Well, maybe it's that people do pay attention to sell in May and go away. The old adage, I heard that. Come back in November after avoid all of the volatility between the 1st of May and the end of October. But I think it's probably more simple than that and has something to do with keeping an eye on what Apple is up to today.
And yeah, I was reading about Apple, and you know, they expect a report, you know, a very positive earnings report, maybe slower than it has been in the past. But they're looking at suppliers, companies that supply whether it's metals or parts for the iPhone and things like that, and they're down a little bit. So they think that might sort of portend slowing for Apple in general.
Well, the other thing that is going on is Apple is also, this gets a little deep in the weeds here, but it's testing a key level ahead of its earnings, which could be signaling some more pain for the stock and a downside risk for the stock rather than, you know, if all goes well and we're going to be trading higher after the announcement of the results this afternoon. And also, there's a report that Apple is going to be buying back more of its stock.
You know, that's interesting you bring that up because, you know, I sort of sing this song all the time with John, so I'll sing it to you instead. But, you know, when these tax cuts came through, the hope was that workers were going to see pay increases. And we've seen a lot of stock buybacks. We've seen things like that. And you know better than me, but the stock buyback, as defenders will say, you know, the board's first duty is to reward its shareholders. I get that, but it benefits the big shareholders or the CEO, things like that. Anyway, Marco Rubio was just interviewed in The Economist, and he was a champion of the tax cuts when they were passed. He says there's still a lot of thinking on the right that if big corporations are happy, they're going to take the money they're saving and reinvest it in American workers. In fact, they bought back shares. A few gave out bonuses. There's no evidence whatsoever that the money that has been massively poured back in, that the money has been massively poured back into the American worker. So in other words, these promises of pay increases haven't quite materialized yet. Is that what you're seeing there as well?
Well, just to echo that, there was a column in the New York Times yesterday to that extent as well. So, you know, what happened to these pay raises? Where did they go? And also that some of the corporations view a buyback as a way to reward their investors.
Well, and I get that, the investors, and then they'll say, well, and a lot of those workers have 401ks and they benefit from that. But okay, maybe in 20 or 30 years. The interesting thing, if you watch it politically, is the Republicans passed this with the idea that it would help them in the elections and help them with voters in general because people would be getting a tax cut. They are getting a tax cut, but they're not getting the increase in wages that they kind of been promised. So they could end up hurting them.
Yeah, the wages have been fairly stagnant.
All right, let's run by one more then. Boeing has been leading the way down on the Dow. Do you know what's going on there?
Boeing's down about 2.46% right now. I don't know, but Boeing's not the only one. Caterpillar is off right now about 2.6%. McDonald's is off 3% today. Walgreens Boots down about 2.6%. There is one bright spot in the Midwest companies, and that is AbbVie. Is up 5.3% today.
I'm so glad you said that. I have a friend who works at AbbVie, is involved there, and he says, you know, you guys never talk about when our stock goes up.
Well,
so a shout out to North Chicago. AbbVie's up over 5% so far today.
Right.
Under Armour having a rough day as well. Is that because they just overspent on endorsements? I mean, you know, everyone wears Under Armour, but they seem to always struggle.
I don't know the answer to that. Whether that's connected to the money they spend on big names endorsing them.
I have heard that before, and as someone who negotiates big contracts, I thought you might be a little defensive there. Thank you very much, Steve Alexander. You've been a great help.
You're welcome.
More from Steve coming up in about 15 minutes or so. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Bertrand, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:20 in the afternoon here in the Allstate Showcase Studio along Michigan Avenue. Okay, in Illinois alone, there are 1.4 million people with a disability. It's about 11% of the population, and only 35% of them are working. So we've got that. And then, you know, we had the economic developer from Kankakee County down yesterday saying that they are in need of workers, so businesses need workers. There are workers available. How do we get them together? That was the focus of a breakfast this morning, hosted in part by the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce. And in the studio with us now, Laura Wilhelm, the director of the Chicagoland Business Leadership Network, and Andy Imperato, who's the executive director of the Association of University Centers on Disability. Welcome to both of you. How was breakfast?
It was great.
Yeah, I have no food, so I hope you had plenty of food.
As the person coming in from DC, I was really impressed with the energy. There's a lot of leadership in the city of Chicago right now on this issue.
How about in DC? Because, you know, the EPA's in the news again today, and that's all about ending regulation, and that's been one of the president's focuses. I would imagine when it comes to people with disabilities and advocates for them, restrictions and regulations can be sort of a scary thing.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag. There's a long history of bipartisan support for disability issues going back to the first President Bush and Bob Dole. The Secretary of Labor right now, Alex Acosta, is actually very passionate about getting more people with disabilities into the labor force. But there is an anti-regulation environment that does affect the ability of folks with disabilities to get supports that they need to get to work.
Have you seen, so there's the environment, but have you seen concrete changes, negative changes? Or positive changes.
We had some proposals around, you know, cuts to Medicaid that we were able to defeat last year, but so we haven't seen dramatic negative changes. No, and there are some positive things on the table, like having to improve wages for people with disabilities.
Laura is here as well. So we've got these workers, and it's an untapped market, right? How do you get those workers to the employers, or maybe how do you get those employers to the workers?
So at the Chicagoland Chamber of Commerce, one of the priorities that our business members identify for us is diversity inclusion in general, but disability inclusion in particular. And the Chicagoland Business Leadership Network is the program at the Chicagoland Chamber that's really focused on disability inclusion. And we have a network of businesses who are working together to strategize around disability inclusion. And we're also trying to connect those businesses to the resources in the Chicago area to find those workers with disabilities.
You know, in reading about the two of you and the event and getting ready to talk with you, I really sort of discovered one of my own biases or prejudices because I came across the word skilled disability workers. And I think my first thought was that these are this is an unskilled labor force, which is an ignorant way to think, right?
Yeah, well, if you think about why do we have a civil rights law like the Americans with Disabilities Act, it's because there are fears, myths, and stereotypes around disabilities that get in the way. I have bipolar disorder. There's a lot of negative things people associate with bipolar disorder. They don't think about Ted Turner and other people who've been very successful with the condition.
I think there's also a common misunderstanding about who people with disabilities are. When you talk about workers with disabilities, it's a really heterogeneous group of people. So I think sometimes people kind of come to this conversation with their own perspectives and whatever their own past experience was with someone with a disability. But it includes, you know, wheelchair users, people with visual impairments, or people with various mental health conditions.
Well, I also read that one of the things holding people back is sort of a willingness to self-identify. And I'm not sure I understand that. Someone explain that for me.
Well, I think a lot of folks have the perception that if they're out at work with their disability, this is where you have a non-visible disability, that it'll hold you back professionally. You might get passed over for the promotion. They'll worry about whether you'll be able to do the travel or something connected to the job. So they don't tell their employer that they have a disability. And we're trying to create an environment where it's to your advantage to be out at work and the employer can leverage your experience to help them learn things and innovate in ways that they might not otherwise.
And it's to all of our advantage, really, right? If we start to realize that most of us, we're all surrounded by people, we're all have one issue or another, and if we accept that and are knowledgeable of it, then we're more accepting of the next person coming in.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and I think a lot of businesses employ a lot more workers with disabilities than they even realize because so many people don't disclose.
All right, so how do you get those? So let's go back to my first question to you. How do you get the employers to those workers? I mean, right? I mean, which comes first, I guess? Do the workers need to seek out I guess typically a worker would seek out a job, but if you are an employer in need of workforce and realize this is untapped, how do you tap it?
So what the Chicagoland Business Leadership Network is trying to do is bring together businesses to talk about what they're doing internally to do more outreach and recruiting, and then how do they hire and retain workers with disabilities. And I think one of the things we want to do is use the power of the business community, bring them together, share information about what's working and what's not working, and then get them connected to the resources they need.
And I would say it's like any other area of diversity. You need to build a pipeline. So you need to find people. Universities. I represent a network of university centers. Universities can help. Vocational rehabilitation can help. Private disability service providers can help to build the pipeline for talent.
I would imagine that I want to believe that we've developed, right? That we are more accepting and it's a better climate now than it was 10 years ago or under the first President Bush when the ADA was passed. Am I correct?
Yeah, you know, I used to work for Senator Tom Harkin from Iowa, and one of the things that he noted was we have a generation of young people who've grown up since the passage of the ADA. He referred to them as the ADA generation. Mm-hmm. He feels like this generation has much higher expectations for what's possible for people with disabilities in the labor force.
Laura, I know you guys, the Chicagoland Chamber is working on a tool, right, to bring people together. Can you tell me about that?
So the Chicagoland Chamber is really one of their big initiatives is to do more workforce development. And we have a new tool that hasn't been launched yet, but it is going to be a resource that it really is designed to try to remove some of the biases that naturally occur in the hiring process. And so we'll be launching that soon.
Laura Wilhelm and Andy Imperato, thanks very much for coming by. I appreciate it.
Now, your noontime check-in with today's business world and more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It's
Steve Bertrand.
Oh, I'm sorry about that. I was ready to go. 12:37 here on the Business Lunch. Suzanne Muchin is in the phone.
I'm not on the phone.
12:37 here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Suzanne Muchin is here in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you.
We've been off the rails a little bit today, so I'm counting on you.
We're going to bring it back.
I wish I had more confidence that you could do that.
Hey!
Suzanne is the co-host of The Big Payoff, a podcast that looks at women in the workplace,
yep.
Right? You can hear it at WGNradio.com and all sorts of places. And she comes here, we talk about gender issues more or less.
Yeah.
And so everyone's talking about Michelle Wolf, and we'll get to that maybe, but I'm intrigued by this NBC story about John Kelly. And the headline of it sort of was that he referred to the president as an idiot. Okay, that's that. That's that. But what struck me was the sentence where, and I don't remember, somehow he was, oh, he referred to women as more emotional than men.
Several times in front of the president.
Do you think that's true?
Do I think it's true that he said it or that women are more emotional?
That women are more emotional.
I do think they're more emotional.
Okay, but you think he shouldn't have said it?
It's not said it or didn't say it. If we want to talk about, do women have a wider and broader range of emotions that they feel comfortable expressing, more
right.
so than men?
Right.
The answer to that is yes.
So but we don't know. He might have said it as a huge compliment.
He could have said right. it as a huge compliment. I think what we don't know but can surmise is what will, and therefore what? It sounds like from the article and from the reporting on it that the point he was making was, and so let's just take what they say with a grain of salt.
Well, that was an implication you could take from it.
Right. right?
Maybe what he's really saying was Mike Pence, he won't open up. Women are so much more emotional.
right. He could have. We could role play. right. You could be John Kelly. I'll be Mike Pence. And we can always create a scenario in which that was an awesome thing to say. Here's what we know. We know that there has been a number of issues around the way women have been spoken about in that office, the way they run, how they dress to work. Remember in the early days where Trump wanted women to dress like women? So these comments don't help, especially taken out of context.
In the early days, that was like 15 months ago. Forget it.
It feels like 10 years ago.
Okay, but here's what jumped out at me. And yep. it was the White House backing up Kelly, saying, look, he has great respect for women. He often will say, I can't speak this way. He won't curse in front of women. Or if he's in a meeting and another guy uses swear words or uses swears, as the kids say,
he swears.
He'll say, hey, there's a lady present.
Right.
Which, when I read that, I started thinking about it. I'm like, well, I don't know if that's a good thing.
I find it wildly offensive.
You do?
I do. First of all, who among us, I mean, I want to talk to the women listening to this show and say, do you not swear, ladies? Is that something we don't do? Why? Because we're not supposed to? That is seriously so incredibly judgmental. And also, so now you're creating a false wall, a border wall, if you will, between the women and the men based on an assumption about the way the men should treat women, which implies in this case with a little more decorum.
Yeah, it right. It struck me as almost demeaning in a way that,
totally.
That you're not my equal. You're
right. I need to take care of you. I need to protect you.
So men should swear like sailors in front of women?
They should swear or not swear. Not all men swear. Not all women don't. I think if an office culture allows for open dialogue and back and forth and heated conversations, and that leads to some swearing, men in the room, women, who cares?
Yeah, okay. That's kind of what I was thinking when I read that. I'm like, I'm not sure I like that.
No.
Michelle Williams, Michelle Wolf, I should
Michelle
say.
Michelle Wolf. I know, right? We're all calling her Michelle. I would think the same way, Michelle Wolf. So
so she came out with a statement today, said she wouldn't take anything back. She had a friend who said, go burn it down, and she did. She said she was writing jokes and performing for the TV audience, not the room.
I think the worst thing that happened here, honestly, was the bait and switch of the people at the event who brought her in the first place. Because as she said, look, like me or don't like me, I have a point of view. This is how I talk. All you have to do is do like one Google search on me and you'd know who I was and what I was going to offer. For the dinner, whoever did the hiring, to come out the next day and say, this is an event that is
about
supposed
unity.
To bring and unify all of our community. And I would, if I could swear right now, I would just swear and go, are you kidding me?
Because
that to me, let me just say this in her defense. She delivered her truth as it always is. She didn't do a bait and switch. That said, do I like what she had to say? I don't. Did I think it was funny? I don't. Do I think she was doing the job she was hired to do? I do.
Okay, I think we sort of agree on that then. It's like buying a Ford and expecting a Mercedes.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you
then
this
don't
is what
have a comedian. Then have somebody who's going to talk about journalistic unity and the way a kumbaya. That's not what they hired her to do.
She could have done it in a way that was more.
But she
amenable.
Wouldn't. That's not who she is. And then get some comedian. I can't name one, but get a comedian who's more embracing of the whole.
They all died in the 1950s.
Exactly. Honestly, can you name one, like, other than Johnny Carson since then? Like, who's a comedian that really inspires unity these days? Often, right? It's hard to name one.
One other thing I want to talk, though, about, and this has to do with sort of the reverse. Maybe it's the same thing about not swearing in front of women. Why is it so offensive to make fun of what Sarah Sanders looks like and not what Newt Gingrich looks like?
Right. I agree with that. I agree with that. And you know, Michelle made a funny...
And maybe
funny,
it's mean and not all of it, but you know what? If we're all equal, damn it, then
I totally
there's not
that.
A different line there.
There's not. I also thought it was funny the next day she said, I said that her eye had a perfect smoky eye.
Okay. Meghan Markle.
So interesting. Let's just go cut right to the chase here. She's a regular person.
Getting married this month to
Prince Harry.
Is it Harry Reasoner, Harry Smith?
She doesn't even have a last name. Oh, yeah. He's like Harry, Prince of Wales. She went to Northwestern. She's a normal person. Just by the act of her getting married to him, they are analyzing her worth, worth to the economy.
She wore a pair of torn jeans.
And they sold out. I mean, the
web traffic went up 200%.
200%. That's not even... They're estimating that her annual worth to the economy in England will be over 150 million pounds a year.
Okay. And so I'm reading this, and I read that she carries a certain bag.
Yes.
And then the bag sells out.
Yes. 5,000% increase to these websites.
To me, that's sort of like the 50-year-old guy wearing the Chris Bryant jersey.
I agree.
There's a little... Really? Do we agree?
I really do agree.
It's kind of... I would use the word pathetic in a way.
I would find it bizarre, to be honest, to the next day or a week later start walking around with her bag. But here's what I really believe. If we want to fix the American economy, we need a princess or a queen. I think we need a princess because I think the queen's kind of like her outfits aren't really...
Yeah,
you know,
I think there
were
some people
out.
Who thought we had a princess. It turns out we don't.
We just don't.
Suzanne Muchen, the co-host of The Big Payoff at WGNRadio.com. Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
It's say that again. Okay, Bennett is in the... It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute. You ready for that?
Oh, yeah.
This is the Wintrust Business Minute.
Got a minute? Good, because I've got the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing the news, providing input, and breaking down the stories that matter to the world of business. So co-working spaces are hot right now, and with these big trends come interesting variations of the business model. And now Chicago has its very own luxury co-working space in the West Loop. Co-Optum has just about everything and more when it comes to shared office spaces for office users and their ideal clientele, bigger companies, and executives. They've got the money. It's not a bad idea, especially since right now it's cheaper than Fulton Market's WeWork offices. But look for prices going up very soon. And oh, it does not stop there for the co-working world. We're going international as the German-based Rent24 plans to open their second, larger office space at 500 North Michigan Avenue, touting 100,000 square feet for co-working customers. When these kind of ideas are expanding all around the world, you know this is a steady field of business. Tune in tomorrow for all of your up-to-date business news on WGN Radio.
Back to Steve Bertrand and the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:52 here along Michigan Avenue. Gary Mills is in the studio. You know Gary. He's been on from time to time, the author of The Bullseye Principle and one of the guys behind Pinnacle Performance, and he has a new book out called... I just did that wrong. He's been on before with The Pin Drop Principle, and the new book is called The Bullseye Principle. Gary, you're a friend, and I need a friend because it's been a rocky show.
Has it?
I was a little off today. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great, thanks. Okay, so The Pin Drop Principle, we talked about communication, right? It was all about taking skills that you've learned as an actor and the work you've done at the Pinnacle Performance and putting that into a book to help people communicate. Did you make mistakes with that one, or why did we come back with the second one?
Great question. So Dave Lewis and I, who I co-founded Pinnacle Performance Company with, we wrote Pin Drop Principle about 6 years ago, and we thought we said everything that we needed to say about communication and influence in that book. But then as the years went along and we're training around the world, 6 continents, almost 50 countries, we realized the way that people are taking in information, putting out information, interacting, communicating with one another was really changing.
Right.
So we knew we had to go back and revisit some of those things from the first book and put in stuff that we didn't have a chance to put in the first
time. I may be a little ahead of myself. So tell me about Pinnacle Performance and why it is you're traveling around the world and picking picking up those cues?
Pinnacle Performance Company is a global communication skills training firm. We train around the world to teach people how to influence emotion to motivate action, to get what you want from your client, your spouse, your kid.
So you'll go to companies around the world, sports teams around the world.
Yeah, we do professional athletes. We do Fortune 500 executives.
And you teach them to communicate.
More effectively, yes.
And do we have a common flaw when it comes to communication?
Yeah, so meetings are generally not very well run around the world, so a lot of productivity is wasted.
If I give this book to bosses, will that get me out of any future meetings?
Here's the great thing is when we wrote the book, we wanted to pinpoint the 10 areas that anyone needs to communicate well to succeed in their career and life.
Right.
And so each chapter lays out, if you're running a meeting, if you're defining your brand, if you're interviewing for a job, if you're trying to influence, if you're trying to build a relationship, here's how to do it. And then there's a tool at the end to help you do that.
The next chapter you didn't get to it was delivering bad news.
Oh, delivering difficult news. Yes, delivering
right,
bad news.
Right, that was
news.
The next chapter yeah. after. And so fire me right now. How do you do that?
Yeah, so first off, you've got to prepare. Before I do this, so I've got to take into consideration how is this person going to react to the message I'm about to deliver, and also what type of questions might they have for me, right? Which is only fair. I need to be ready to answer those questions.
Right. So, right, that's a good point. So, because you might think that when you say you're fired, that that's the end of it, but for the recipient, that's really the beginning of it.
Right. They're gonna have a lot of questions. Who made this decision? How did this happen? Where do I go from here? How are you going to help me from here? This doesn't seem fair. And you've got to be ready with empathy and with active listening to be able to address those.
Active listening and empathy are two of the most important aspects, right?
Yeah, and a recent study out of Brigham Young found that people don't like to beat around the bush. If you're giving me bad news, very little buffer. Just give it to me.
Right. That's what I was thinking when you said, yeah. If you're going to fire me, don't start by giving me 5 minutes
small
about...
Small talk and, hey, did you see the Cubs game
I know
last
this,
night?
Right, exactly. Because I'm sweating already. Right. I know I'm not in there to talk about the right. Cubs game. Tell me about the worst speaker of all time, and please tell me it wasn't me.
It was not you. The opening chapter of the book, we tell for the very first time a story that's never been told. If anyone listening right now, wherever you are in the world, Google the worst speaker of all time or the worst speech of all time, either one, you'll get up to 18 million results. But the very first result on the very first page is a politician named Phil Davison.
Okay.
Who gave a speech in 2010 that made him the worst speaker of all time, giving the worst speech of all time. So if you haven't seen it, definitely go to YouTube and check it out. It's amazing. So what happened is about 5 years ago when Pin Drop Principle came out, that speech went viral and this guy was famous for being the worst speaker of all time. So Dave and I were doing a keynote somewhere and we started talking afterward. We play that video and we said, I wonder what happened to that guy after he became famous for being the worst speaker of all time. And could we have helped him if we would have taught him our methodology before he gave that speech? What would have happened? So we went and found him. We brought him to Chicago, and I spent 2 hours with him teaching him our methodology. And then at the end of it, we said, do you still remember the words to that speech that made you famous? To our shock, he did. And we said, let's redo it now. Knowing what you know, check it out now. Let's see what the difference is.
And that so speaks to the fact that it's not the words, right? It's
right.
not the words. It's the way the words are delivered.
Right. And the problem with him was the words were fantastic, except the delivery didn't match up.
Right.
So there was incongruence, so it just looked like he looked like a maniac.
And now he's running the world?
And he's not running the world now, but he speaks at conferences, he makes appearances, he has a podcast, he speaks on politics. And he's a great guy.
I mean, you travel the world with this, so let's get back to where we started. How has communication changed that created the need for the bullseye principle?
Yeah, good question. Everywhere we go, people run into the same problem, that they have an objective with their meeting, with their performance review, with their presentation, but at the end of it, nothing happens. There's no result, and nothing is achieved. And the reason that happens is because their intention is not strong enough. So what we teach in our methodology is you have to analyze your audience, who are you talking to? Second is you have to understand how you want them to feel and what you want them to do as a result of your message being heard. And then finally, you have to modify your delivery, which means everything has to be lined up. So if I'm giving you good news, I want to get you excited about a new proposal that we're putting forward. You got to see excitement, hear excitement, and feel excitement from me. Otherwise, you're not going
to
buy in.
We're out of time. You come to this knowledge in part through your acting, right?
Yes.
Okay, but that might imply that some of the conveyance of the message is insincere, that it's acting. So tell me about sincerity when it comes to taking on acting principles.
Yeah, so all of our methodology is based on the principles professional actors know, how to engage an audience, be confident, persuasive, influential with your communication. And with that, you have to prepare, you have to be ready, but you have to have a goal that you're going after. Believable truth is what Stanislavski, the famous acting teacher, used to strive for.
Gary Mills, the name of the book, The Bullseye Principle, Wiley Press, right?
Yes, Wiley published this one as well.
All right, check it out. Nice. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, great to see you.